Welcome to Ballsy, the podcast where I interview successful artists and creators on how they got the balls to sell their art and turn their practice into a profitable business. As a former entrepreneur turned artist, I realized that being an artist is basically like running a small startup, and you, the artist, are the CEO. I talk to artists about their businesses, talk real numbers, growth hacks, tools and tricks, and how they were ballsy enough to make that their career. Okay, everybody. Welcome to Ballsy. It takes balls to make art. Today, we are fortunate enough to have an artist that I've been a fan of for quite some time, a street artist of sorts, who goes by the name of Plastic Jesus. His real name is Nick. So welcome, Nick. To get started, I think it's best that people have an idea who they're talking to. So can you give us your social channels so people can see, so they can like play along, and give us a little bit about your background?
Sure. Instagram, obviously, is the primary social channel, as it is for many artists, and that's just at Plastic Jesus. Facebook is Plastic Jesus Art. Twitter is Plastic Jesus 9. It's 9 because my original Plastic Jesus 1 was banned because of something I said about Donald Trump, so we won't go into that right now.
But we'll get there.
So, yeah, I mean, I started off doing street art, purely doing stencil pieces in the street. And very quickly, my work started getting traction. So I started getting approached by people saying, hey, where can we see your art? Where can we buy your art? That's how I started out.
Actually, let's go a little further back, because I'm always fascinated about like origin stories. Before you were an artist, what was your profession? And what was that journey from side hustle, hobby, just shits and giggles, to actually something that generated income?
Firstly, once I find out how to generate income, I'll let you know. Because still after 10 years. No, my career before that was, I was a news photographer. I worked for newspapers and magazines, traveling all over the world, covering investigations, doing major events. I was in Japan just after the big earthquake there and the issues of Fukushima. I was in Haiti after the earthquake. I'd covered stories including people trafficking, money laundering, organized crime, and so on. And that was something I did for 20 odd years. The transition to become an artist wasn't a conscious one, unlike so many people out there have this passion to be an artist. That really wasn't my driving force at all. The transition happened when I was becoming more and more disillusioned with the news media I was working for. As a news photographer, your work is a kind of a blend of real stories, tragedy, incidents, investigations, and then a certain amount of kind of, should we say, celebrity news. But due to the way that media has evolved over the past few decades, it's those celebrity stories that gets the clicks. It's if you've got Kim Kardashian on the front of your glossy magazine at the checkout, you'll sell another 50,000-100,000 copies or something. And sadly, more and more of the assignments I was getting commissioned to do were heading in that direction. So I was looking for new ways to communicate visually issues that I felt strongly about. I'm not a very good writer, so that was out of the question. I do a bit of music, but not enough that could be classified as a success or pending success for me. So creating visual art was almost a natural progression for me. The way I merged the two together was almost by accident. Again, as a photographer, I had a portfolio, but as a news photographer, your portfolio becomes a portfolio of the worst possible incidents you can imagine: civil unrest, disaster, death, destruction. Now, if you want to sell yourself as a creative photographer, that is never going to fly. You need to show that you can do beautiful work and so on. So I hit on this idea about recreating some of Banksy's iconic street art pieces as photographs. So, So I started just doing one as a photo shoot with a friend of mine. I did Banksy's flower thrower.
Okay.
And I just put it on social media and it got incredible traction. It really did. And everybody was commenting how much they loved it. So I ended up actually creating nearly 20 pieces of some of his most iconic pieces: the flower thrower, the two cops kissing, Mona Lisa with the RPG, what else, the maid sweeping under the wall, and so on.
And these were the
real life people, real life situation as a photograph. So effectively, I was trying to reverse engineer Banksy's pieces. thinking if Banksy had seen this in the street, this is what he would have seen that created, that culminated in that piece of art. It was a lot of fun to do. I produced it. I had hair, makeup, spent ages getting the costumes. For me, getting the smallest detail right was vital. So sometimes I would spend weeks looking for a small detail of a costume or a prop or something. And if people want to take a look, if they Google "You Are Not Banksy" photo recreations, you'll find them. And one of my favorite ones was, in fact, there's a small boy with a machine gun, and the machine gun's got Crayola crowns in it. And that was great fun to build that prop. So that, I suppose, got me looking at street art way more than any sane person normally would. Analyzing how Banksy would have created it, where the viewer is in relationship to the piece. For example, are you direct in line with the eyes of the subject? Are you below, are you to the left, to the right? Looking for backgrounds to get those all right. And that then led me to realize just how powerful a simple stencil piece of art could be. The first stencil piece I did was when Lance Armstrong was facing his drug-taking issues, shall we say. And I did a piece which was Lance Armstrong on his bike connected up to an IV drip. And I put that on the street a few days before he did his interview with Oprah Winfrey. Now, I'm fortunate, having spent 20 years as a photojournalist, that firstly, I know how to engage people in a visual way. Sometimes on a newspaper assignment, you'll be on assignment for days or even weeks and you have one image that needs to connect with the viewer. So that was the first thing that benefited me. But I also had hundreds, if not thousands, of news contacts. I can literally pick up the phone to a news editor at CNN, at the Daily Mail, at the Guardian, at the BBC, and they know me, they know my name, and they know what I'm putting up is probably worth a look. So I've got this unfair advantage that most artists don't have, but it's worked well.
So do you actually pick up the phone and call some other reporters and say, hey, by the way, this stencil is up, go take a look at it? And that kind of starts the story?
It's even more strategic than that. I will put out a press release a few days before I do
it.
In the same way a PR company or a publicist would do, I will say to KTLA or the BBC or NBC, Thursday midday, artist Plastic Jesus is doing something on, just say, Hollywood Boulevard. This is embargoed. This is the story to go with it. There'll be pictures sent from the location on the day, or if you want to get your own crew there, they need to be there by midday.
So you like literally just write a press release and pitch your own story.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Oh, it's fucking brilliant. And by the way, how obvious?
Fortunately, I've got the experience and the ability to do that, which is a great advantage. But saying that, an early piece I did was, I think there was a story that said that rebels in Syria were using children as soldiers. So I created this piece, which I call War Child, which is a young boy, 7-8 years old, and he's got a teddy bear in one hand, a plushie toy in one hand, and in the other hand he's got an AK-47. He's standing there in short combat pants, a wife beater or whatever, a bandana tied around his hair, and bullets in a strap across his body. Now, I knew if I went to Melrose, if I put that piece up as I did at 4 o'clock in the morning, if I put a piece up saying Plastic Jesus has created a new stencil depicting a young child dressed as a soldier, nobody would give a damn. So I went out 4 a.m. on Melrose, took photographs of it at first light, and the press release went along the lines of, is this the latest Banksy that mysteriously appeared in Los Angeles overnight? The 3-foot-high figure, blah, 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 blah. After I painted it, took the photos, put the press release out, I went home, get a few extra hours sleep. I went back there about 10 o'clock, and there were, I think, 2 or 3 satellite trucks and TV crews there shooting this. So it's not just what you do and putting it out there. It's finding a hook to publicize what you're doing.
Okay, so I have 2 questions from this one. So you have the actual, what debatably is the harder skill set, right? Which is the create cool art, but you create art with message and meaning and then actually have a hook and are able to get the media to come pick it up. Have you been able to pick up the other half, which is translate that back into sales? Or is that how the art then sells, or is that notoriety just drives so much traffic that drives the sales? Like what?
Yeah, generally what you said, the second part, that the notoriety helps people firstly become aware of your work.
Right.
It raises your profile as an artist. Quite a lot of the street art pieces that you do and the pieces that people may have seen of mine online, in fact, don't sell. They're too controversial. It's no secret that I'm no fan of Donald Trump, and leading up to his presidency, during his presidency, and even now, I've created quite a bit of Donald Trump artwork. Now, that doesn't sell very well. If you love Trump,
right, you probably wouldn't want to. You don't want it. Right.
If you hate Trump, you wouldn't want a reminder on your living room wall every day about Trump. But what it does do, it then brings eyes onto your social media, and people then say, hey, where can I see your work? What galleries are you with? So that's the way it's translated. But saying that, there are art collectors out there that buy stuff because it is quite...
It's controversial.
Yeah. One of the pieces I did that went viral was when Trump announced he was going to build a big, beautiful wall between the US and Mexico, I went and built a small kind of 6-inch high mini wall around his car on Hollywood Boulevard, complete with razor wire along the top and all this kind of stuff.
Fantastic.
It literally took an hour to make. In fact, I wanted to do something about this announcement he had made about the border wall, and I'm breaking my brain, what can I do? I'd left the studio, and so many artists, you can ponder for days and days and try and come up with ideas, and then you'll be in the shower or walking around the supermarket or whatever, and this idea will just come into your head. And that's what happened to me. I was driving home from the studio, this idea came in my head. Instead of going home, I went up to Hollywood Boulevard, measured up his star to see the size, came back into the studio and started chopping up wood for it. Now, that piece did actually sell. It sold to an art collector who I think loved the piece, loved the message for it, but also knew that it would be great to support me, and I really appreciate the fact that he did buy it. So I'm not saying you cannot sell art that is too controversial, but it's a harder sell.
So let's go back a little bit. So you're a photographer, you're making some street art on the side, you're getting some notoriety, you're getting, I would assume that's leading into some sort of sales. At what point did you decide, like, I don't want to be a photographer, I don't want to take pictures of war-torn countries anymore, I want to make art full-time. Like, how did that process, was it a wake-up one day kind of moment, or is it something that you were, like, built over time?
I transitioned to art very quickly because very quickly interest and orders started coming in.
Okay.
Now, I never had that decision that, yes, I want to be an artist. I'll be quite honest with you, I still want to be a press photographer. I love that life. I love that industry. However, the industry isn't as it was anymore. Real news as I was shooting, I know a lot of photographers and I speak to them sometimes on a weekly basis. And it's difficult to sustain an income as a news photographer covering real stories these days.
And it's really?
I know a lot of guys that perhaps drive Uber or do food delivery, and they have their cameras in the back of the car. If they get an assignment, boom, and they're off. And these are guys that have traveled all over the world for major publications. It's just an industry which has absolutely collapsed.
That's so distressing to hear.
Yeah, I still do some journalism. I tend to pick and choose what I do, but it's not generally a news organization phoning me up and saying, hey, can you do this assignment for me? It's stuff that I see. And I think, hey, actually, that's a story. I'm going to go and shoot it. I'm going to write something about it and put it to a newspaper who I think will use it. In fact, I think I've got a piece going in the UK Daily Mail this week. I've got another one I'm doing downtown next week. So I'm still putting stuff out there.
I bet you the irony is that the kind of cool art messaging and storytelling, I'm sure, gets more traction than the news stories.
Yeah, exactly. And to make a consistent living as a journalist now, unless you're a staffer for a news organization or an agency, to make a canvas or a piece of art and sell it for $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 is achievable once you get to a certain level of notoriety and you're working with certain galleries. These days, to find a news story and set of pictures that will sell for that kind of money is a lot tougher.
And now with ChatGPT and DALL-E and everything, it's in Midjourney, it's even harder because you can just like, hey, I need X. That's actually a nice segue. So in terms of, first, let's talk about what I really like and respect about you is you sell the gamut. So what, you have originals, the sculptures and paper, you do prints, you do merch, can you go through the whole list of the items that you sell? And with them, just because I'm always curious, what percentage-wise, like what sells the most? Like what are the ones that really move?
That's an interesting question, and I think it's something that every artist should be aware of. I'm terrible, just wind things back a bit, I'm terrible at doing accounts as most, and bookkeeping as most artists are. You know, I'm a creator, I don't do numbers and stuff, you know? But recently, probably about a year ago, I got a company doing my bookkeeping, and every month they send me a profit and loss, and it's very clear where your money's going, and so on. By that, you can analyze also what's selling. Now, the most expensive pieces I do are sculptures, which are the melted guitar. I think I've got one behind me somewhere. Let me just spin this around a bit. There's one actually, you know, that. The Oscar statues that I put out on Hollywood Boulevard, they're around 20 to 30K. I've got some more expensive canvases, 10 to 20K mark. I've got some mid-price canvases, 3 to 5 to 6K. For me, the best-selling pieces are the champagne fire extinguishers that I sell. And they start at about they start at 2,800, 3,300, and just over 6,000. And to me, they are the best-selling pieces. They're in that kind of mid-price point. You don't have to be mega rich to buy one. You need to have some spare money, sure. But they sell well. Prints are around 150, 250, 350. And then the merch is just t-shirts, you know, 30 bucks.
Do you sell a lot of merch? Because you like your shirt that you're wearing now, Stop Making Stupid People Famous is like one of my favorite. That was a nice little meme for a while. Do those things sell as much as I think they sell, or is that just a figment of my imagination?
I've sold probably about $50,000 worth of t-shirts, which sounds great.
Sure.
That's not great for a t-shirt company. It's good for an artist.
Okay.
You know, and those orders come in, you know, a few each week, which is great. Prints are important because it's people that love your work that want to not only support you, but want to be associated with your work and want a piece for their home. They can get a few hundred bucks together often. So that's a good kind of segue into buying art. In fact, I get people that come to me and perhaps buy a print for 150 bucks, and they might say, hey, I've been saving 10, 20 bucks each week from my wages. I've got enough now. Can I have one of these prints from you? Which is amazing to think that people like your work enough to effectively get it out, to put money from something else that they could spend into a fund where they can buy your art. And then sometimes those people will come back, and I've tried to release some canvases at fairly low price as well, $300, $400, $500. And I do that so people can buy into original art. And often when I do something like that, the people will come back to me and say, this is the first, thank you for doing this.
Yeah.
This is the first original piece of art I've ever bought. And it's so empowering and satisfying to do that for people. I know it sounds crazy, but they're almost grateful for me giving them an opportunity to give some of their money to me. That's not intended disrespectfully at all, but to think that I'm doing something which leads them along that route is just gratifying for me.
You make something that people connect with. Beauty of art.
And
now, do you make... Oh, go ahead.
I've got multi-millionaire, even billionaire buyers who buy art, and they can say they like something, and they just order a money transfer to come over and they buy it. And that is great. But on a personal kind of deeper level, for me, it's perhaps those students or somebody who's in a fairly low paid job who saves up 10 bucks a month or 10 bucks a week and says, hey, I can now afford this from you. They're the ones that they touch me more in terms of, you know, here.
Yeah, I'm sure. And that's also, those are the ones that later in life will become your bigger collectors. Like, they stick with it. And that's what most artists don't realize. Like, the idea of creating entry price point work is important because it allows you to reach just such a broader audience. There's but only so many people who can buy expensive work.
Exactly.
Now, the stuff like the t-shirts and the prints, and is that stuff that you farm out to other people to fabricate, or do you do all that stuff yourself? Or do you have services that provide it? Is that, where do you fall on that line?
Yeah, with the merch, I started off screen printing myself and then realized there's not much I hate more in life than screen printing. It's just not me. It's a lot of cleanup. If you haven't got the facilities for cleanup, it's fucking messy. It's fucking smelly.
Yeah.
No. So I started contracting that out to local t-shirt companies here in LA. I went through lots of t-shirt manufacturers to find the ones that I like, and they're not the cheapest, but they're good quality. They're nice. They wear well and so on. But there's always this conflict when you have an art studio. And for some time, I was producing everything myself in the studio. So I had t-shirts, hoodies, sweatpants, hats, all stacked up here in the studio in boxes. And then I'd be cutting sheets of plywood and sanding for 2-3 days. And you've got all this dust in the air going over all the bags. Inventory control and logistics are very difficult if you're selling fairly low price items and need to sell a lot of them. If I sell a t-shirt, I make 10, 15 bucks. If I sell one of my champagne fire extinguishers, I make 10 times that in terms of margin. So unless you're shifting large volume of merch, it's a difficult balance. It's a difficult gig, basically. Some of the t-shirts I still get printed locally and then I ship from here, which means I'm not taking that much space up in my studio. Other ones are done on a direct-to-garment, direct-to-print type basis where the order comes in, I send the order off, I don't even ship it, it's shipped by the printing company.
Drop shipping is a wonderful thing.
Exactly,
And I see also you teach workshops.
Yeah, that came about because I got a number of requests, and whilst I'm in the studio doing stuff which I totally take for granted every day, particularly I'm just cutting a stencil, but it's stuff that people don't normally venture into doing. So pre-COVID, I was doing about one workshop a month with about 10, 12 people. They're always fully booked. And they're a lot of fun. I enjoy doing them.
Okay.
I've not had a bad report back from anybody doing a workshop. They've all left great feedback. The interesting thing is, like, when you do a workshop, quite often you'll get somebody who does some art and wants to include perhaps stencil making in their art. It might be a husband, a wife, a boyfriend, or girlfriend. And they'll turn up here at 9:30 for the workshop, and they'll bring with them their partner. And when I start, I go around the table finding out what everybody does and what they hope to get from the workshop. And then occasionally you'll get one where perhaps the guy would say, oh yeah, it's my girlfriend, she's an artist, she thought she'd bring me along. And he was there with this kind of almost reluctant attitude. I can guarantee after the workshop, the one person who sends me multiple emails saying they had a great time and pictures of the stencils they've made and ask me questions, how do I do this, how do I make that, it will be that guy. And I'm so pleased that I've been part of that conversion for them.
It's conversion therapy.
Yeah, exactly.
That's amazing. It sounds like you have a pretty big studio. Do you have a team around you? Like, obviously you said you have someone who's helping with you with accounting. Do you have studio assistants? Do you have, like, how have you grown? Do you have obviously you don't have a publicist because you do it all yourself. But like,
just interrupt there. Whenever I do a street piece and it gets picked up by, you know, CNN, NBC, BBC, Daily Mail, I'll get a flurry of emails the following days from publicists saying, hey, Blessed Jesus, we've been following you for a while. We love your work. We saw your piece in the Daily Mail or on CNN. We'd love to do your publicity for you. And I just reply, the fact you saw it on the Daily Mail, the BBC, probably means I'm doing okay with the publicity.
Exactly.
Yes, I do have a team. My studio is actually 2 850-square-foot studios joined together. I've just got a big hole in the wall. So I've got around 1,600 square feet. And yes, I do have assistants. I have one full-time assistant, Rachel, who is absolutely amazing. And another one who helps me when I need her called Dee. They're both incredible. They're both artists in their own right. But they're both so conscientious. And I don't know, they seem happy to work for me. So I'm the big winner here.
Yeah, for sure.
It's so often important as an artist, you get so focused and inside your own head about a piece. And it's so important to ask somebody else's opinion, if that opinion is coming from the right place. So I'll show them my ideas before I even carry them out. And hey, what do you think of this? And they'll often come back and say, yeah, we like it. You could do this to it, or you could also do this to it as well. And that's so important because I think an artist will I'm not sure if insular is the right word or self-centered or whatever. I don't know. But it's so important to get other opinions on what you're doing in terms of the creativity and the practical way that you're making it. Quite often, they'll find better ways to make the stuff than I do. And I find them, I'll come around and they'll do stuff. I wouldn't use the term cutting a corner, but they'll do something in a much more efficient way. And they'll be creating art at a better quality than I do because they're doing it more often.
And how much time do you actually spend making the art versus all the things you have to do to sell the art, do the art, inventory the art, all the other pieces? Like, what percentage is actually art making versus business running?
probably, and I know it's probably a wrong answer here, probably 90 to 95% is doing the art, but that's only because I probably don't spend the time analyzing what I do as I should do, which means that now I've got somebody doing my bookkeeping. It's great because it's all laid out there in black and white. I don't spend the time doing any strategic marketing. I design something new or make something. I just, boom, put it up on Instagram and hope for the best. There's no big rollout procedure of a new piece, not usually anyway. So I probably don't spend the time I should. I don't continue relationship building with clients once they've bought stuff, which everybody says you've got to do. I'm just very bad at all that. I love making stuff. It's as simple as that.
That's great. I find that the bigger I get, the less time I actually spend. I guess I'm making art, but I'm doing like more digital stuff and more like it's more planning and less the physical doing, which is the stuff I actually like.
Which is good in a way to have assistance, because there's a lot of the manufacturer that I can get my assistants to do, and that stuff is, I wouldn't say it's not creative. It might be building wooden cases or priming canvases or getting these fire extinguishers made ready to ship out. That's not a huge amount of creative element. They'll do it to a very high standard, which frees me up to try and do new stuff.
It keeps you creative.
Yeah, exactly. It's that stuff that builds the business, yeah.
Now, where do most, you had mentioned galleries before, like where do most of your sales come from? Is it mostly Instagram? Is it word of mouth? Is it galleries? Is it dealers? Is it online art sites? What does your inbound traffic look like?
Probably 50-50 between direct sales and galleries.
Oh, okay.
Sales, I include things like Instagram into that. Things that I'm putting out there and people saying to me, hey, how much is this piece? And then going through the transaction and buying it, which is great. I've got some very good galleries I work with. Wall Space here in Los Angeles, Lurie Gallery here in Los Angeles, Bruce Lurie Gallery here.
I know this stuff.
Kraut Gallery over in New York.
Yeah, I know those guys also.
Cartman Gallery over in the Netherlands as well. And these people that have been with me since the start and very supportive. I must admit, generally, I'm not a lover of galleries.
Quiz.
You read about galleries and probably how important it is to match up with the right gallery. Previously, that is the case. But now, as an artist, you can have this direct connection with your viewers, with your clients, with your buyers. And I know that is really affecting galleries. Now, when you bear in mind that most galleries would take 50% commission, and it's a strange business model. You rent a small retail premises. Some of them don't even do that now. And you paint it white, you put up some spotlights. You get artists to send you your inventory that you don't pay for. The artist pays for shipping as well. And then when it sells, you pay the artist 50%, sometimes a month or two later.
Or never at all.
It's fine if it's a kind of relationship where the gallery introduces you to new clients that you wouldn't otherwise have. And that's really what you've got to emphasize with the relationship. And that's how the relationship does work. And it works with the galleries that I have. You've got to, with a gallery, you've also got to take something to the equation as well. There's no point just approaching a gallery saying, hey, I made this canvas, will you sell it for? You've got to have your own profile. You've got to have your own brand, as it were, already.
Yeah,
particularly these days. For me, Instagram is great. You've got such a broad demographic of people on there. You've got people who quite literally live on the streets and have no money that like your work. And then you've got billionaires living perhaps overseas in castles. I've got a German collector who spent a lot of money with me a few years ago, and he actually owns his own polo team and vineyard, and I think he lives in a multi-million dollar home. A few celebrities as well. And that's the interesting thing, that a gallery will often have some kind of bell or entry phone on the door. And if they don't like the look of you, they won't let you in. And a gallery will actually tell you, in terms of your business, you should not be producing low-priced items, because it's going to turn off these people that are at the high end of the business. Now, to me, I know, call me a socialist or whatever, that goes against the grain with me. I want to be able to connect with people on lower income, with lower revenue pieces as well.
Yeah. One thing I fight with that all the time, because like the gallery's there because it's good for brand association, right? To work with big brands, there's some interesting things there. But at the same time, it comes with, I take all the cost and you get half the money. It doesn't, the economics are fucking so stupid. Only artists could fall for that deal, right?
If you break it down into numbers as well, if a gallery sells, if you send a piece to a gallery that's, say, retail at I don't know, just say $2,000. The gallery might discount it by 20%, so you're down to $1,600. So they'll pay you $800. Out of that $800, you've got perhaps $200 of material, $50 of shipping. So
what throw a little labor in there, you're down to $550, $600.
$400 from a piece that retailed at $2,000. So it's a tough gig at times.
Yeah, for sure.
The interesting thing about Instagram, as I said, is you have this kind of broad demographic of people there, and you never know where they lie on that chart of available revenue.
Go ahead.
Now, if somebody sends me an Instagram message, if their profile is public, I'll look. I'll see if there's pictures of them wearing their Rolexes, driving their Ferraris, or if, in fact, they're a student, or pictures of their friends hanging out at the local mall or whatever, and that would give you a good idea. I used to spend a lot of time going backwards and forwards with people. Now, if somebody asks you, I learned a long time ago that if somebody comes to you and says, how much is that? The last thing you do is tell them the price. The first thing you do is, oh, that's a one-off canvas. It's 30 inches by 40 inches. What other art have you got in your collection? Blah, 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 this kind of stuff. And you eventually get to the price of the piece. I used to waste a lot of time doing all that. If somebody comes back to me and says, how much is this piece? Now, I won't even say, thanks for your inquiry, blah, blah, blah.
I'll send them a link.
I would just send them a dollar sign with the numbers. $5,000. Send. That's it. Then if they come back to me and say, what size is it? How many are you making? When was it made? They've already validated that we're in that ballpark for them to be able to afford the art.
Like it's funny how as your career matures and how you mature as an artist, like that relationship and just the patience to deal with the back and forth, like how that presents itself. Now, do you do just Instagram? Do you use TikTok or YouTube? And how much time do you spend a day doing it?
I don't spend a lot of day. Instagram, I go through, if I'm doing a new piece, there'll be a few posts over a few days.
Okay.
Sometimes it will go for several days without posting, which I know is against every rule that they say in social media. I do Facebook as well, but I've got the two linked, so anything I paste on Instagram goes to Facebook anyway. The audiences can be quite different as well, because on Facebook people want more engagement as well. They'll often start a discussion about a piece, whereas Instagram might just be a thumbs up emoji or a heart emoji or a thumbs down and pile of shit emoji or something. So the way in which people respond is different across the platforms. So for me, I think I've got about 72,000-73,000 people followers on Instagram. Facebook, I think about 12,000. Twitter, as I say, it's pretty new, and there's like about 2,000 there. I did have about 10, but I kind of burned it.
Yeah, I still have never gotten used to the Twitter thing. It's never been my best medium.
No, I don't think it's for artists. When you think about it, we're both visual artists. What we make is visually appealing.
Yeah.
And Twitter doesn't really lend itself well to that, whereas Instagram, it's the picture up first before any caption. So I think that the simple basics, the basic logistics of it, Instagram, you see the picture first. So I think that works for a lot of artists.
And so you just post when you feel like posting. You don't have a – you're not – and do you ever do stuff with it? Like you never do ads or anything like that, do you?
No, I tried to get my head around Facebook ads and it's made my brain bleed basically.
Same.
Also, if you put a link to your store, my store includes these champagne fire extinguishers and also some cocaine themed pieces. So very quickly they get blocked and taken down.
Oh, interesting.
So forget about the First Amendment. It doesn't apply to
your own. If it's too druggy, they don't take it. Yeah, I went through my drug art phase a while back and had similar issues. Now, in terms of business-wise, what do you find you spend like most of your money on? Like, you're spending it on art supplies, are you spending it on staff, are you spending it on, like, where does it, I always try to follow the money, right? Like, where's it going?
I'll be completely frank with you. The space cost me $3,500 here in Los Angeles. When we're busy, I've got most of my assistants in. That's an expensive outlay as well. And then Home Depot. I love the store, but I hate their politics. I spend a fucking fortune there, really. In fact, as an artist, I buy way more from Home Depot than I do from the local art stores. So that's a lot of my money goes, yeah.
Okay. Now, I'm always curious to see where people spend their loot, so to speak.
Yeah.
Hold on. I just had a question for you. It just jumped in and out of my head. You had mentioned that you found someone to manage your finances. Is that like a service, or is that like just a good bookkeeper that you found? Or is that like something that like people like me can do?
Yeah, they don't actually manage it as such. They just do bookkeeping. So they are linked to all my accounts, and they divide everything up into separate categories and then send me the report. So they're not saying, hey, you're overspending here or you need to curtail. It's for me to analyze what I'm spending, and it's pretty.
But they will tell you, you made 40% on this piece, you made 20% on this one, and so you get a sense.
They tell me you lost 30% this month. 30% this month. So it's more along those lines, yeah. They won't break it down piece by piece, or at the end of the day, a profit and loss is just that. It will say, this is what you spent for your business, this much on rental for your studio, this much on help, this much on materials, this much on transport, and this is what you made from sales. And at the end of the day, yeah, you subtract one from the other to arrive where you.
And you obviously are pretty prolific. You make like how much? Like you make a good amount of art. How do you keep track of it all?
How do I keep track of what I've actually made? A lot of it is actually made to order. As I said, the best selling pieces that I make are, as I said, are those champagne fire extinguishers. And what we do is we make the components for those. We'll have the cases made ready and painted. We'll have the fire extinguishers made ready and painted. And then an order comes in, and we just have to put the two together and do the final assembly. Do a little bit of manufacturing on it, but it's in component form when we just assemble them. So that's what we have here in stock. And then I did a show the end of last year. I've still got a few canvases left from that and so on. So they're here in the studio. When you do new stuff like that, if you have a show, your own show, often galleries will want to display some of that as well. So you can offload it to a gallery for a month or two and then onto another one. So I don't really keep much in the way of records of inventory. I've got a spreadsheet, which I use iCloud for, and there I record all sales. The piece number, of the description, the name of the person it's sold to, and the price it's sold and the date. I don't record order number or anything like that, because as long as I've got their name in there, I can then go to Shopify, which is my main store.
Okay.
And I can just look them up. And Shopify gives you some great tools, actually. If you're launching a new piece that you want to release to a select number of clients, you can, for example, just say, give me everybody's email addresses who spent more than $5,000, or people who you're releasing a new print, perhaps you just want to release that first with your print buyers, and you can do that. So that's all very useful.
That's good. Yeah, I've just become I used to be a Squarespace guy, and then I started using Wix, and I thought it was the worst one. It turns out to be, of all the ones I've used, it turns out to be the one I like the most. It's right, very.
I started with Big Cartel, but it was too limited.
Oh, okay.
Shopify is great. It's pretty complex.
That's what I've heard.
Expensive. Shopify cost me for my annual subscription to it just under $1,000 a year.
Okay.
I think it's $900. But then I think I'm also paying, 3% transaction fees, and there's other fees there. So I'm paying usually between $200 and $300 a month on top of that. So you're looking at around $3,000, $4,000 a year I'm paying to Shopify.
Yeah, but they're the back end of your business.
Exactly.
Do you do commissions ever?
I do, yeah, I do. And I get a number of commissions, either based on existing ideas that I've got. Somebody might want something in a different brand or a different color or a different size. Or somebody will just say to me, hey, I'm in the tech industry. I drive a Ferrari. I'd love to commission a piece of art. What can you do? And I'll come up with some ideas. They'll then say, yeah, great, make it.
And I assume you charge a premium for that?
Yeah, I do. I'm working with a real estate company in New York, in the Bronx at the moment. They have a building and they're inviting a number of artists, myself, Wordsmith, Wisby, I think Mr. Brainwash as well. They have a whole lobby area and some elevator areas that they want art in. So I'm just getting a unique proposal together for them as the other artists are. So that'd be an interesting one if it comes off.
That's cool. Now, do you ever do, because you're somewhat controversial, so do brands like come to you for like brand collaborations, or like people scared of you because you push buttons a lot?
I've done a few brand collaborations. I think it does scare people off. I had McDonald's come to me, and I...
Really?
Yeah, I really wasn't. I didn't want to do it anyway, if I'm honest. They came to me, and they wanted me to create a piece of art to go out at night. You know, the idea was, the narrative of the commercial was, I create a piece of art in the studio. There's no... And it's not until you get the final reveal that they see what it is. So We create the piece in the studio, we go out at night time, all hooded up, we go and spray it on a wall somewhere, and the big reveal is this, I don't know, fucking burger, fucking double cheeseburger or something. And no doubt they were probably offering good money. And I just thought, I don't really want to do this, but if they're offering good money, does it make me a hypocrite if I do it? So I actually pondered on it. I went back to the agent who contacted me and said, look, I'm concerned because this has legal implications. Your client will in fact be endorsing or perhaps promoting illegal vandalism. Are they aware of that? So the agent went back to McDonald's, who ran it past their lawyers, who said, no, we can't fucking do this. So there's that side of it. But also, yeah, I suppose my brand is tarnished by, if you want to call it tarnished, I think it's actually a credit, but it is intrinsically linked with controversy and so on. But that's fine. I wouldn't be me if I wasn't doing that.
Now, do you still sneak out in the middle of the night and spray paint stuff and stencil? Or have you gotten to the point where, like, the risk reward for doing things you can go to jail for is no longer in the...
You know, no, I'm not doing nighttime stuff anymore for a couple of reasons. I stopped when COVID hit for the simple reason that nobody was going on the streets to see your work anyway. Also got a 16-month-old baby daughter as well. So
mazel tov.
Yeah, thank you. I need to be around for breakfast and that kind of stuff. But also, I know a lot of people, there's a lot of prestige to doing that kind of late night illegal street stuff, but for me it's never been about that. It's been about the message of the piece. Although doing something illegally is a message in itself, it's uncurated, it's unedited, nobody says you can do it, so that itself sends a message to the world. But to go out at 4 o'clock in the morning and stand there against a wall that perhaps smells of piss because homeless guys have been pissing up that wall for god knows how many weeks, and you come out and you feel, you've got to go home and have a shower. It's just not, you don't feel clean after doing that kind of shit. You're covered in paint, you're smelling of piss. It's like, it's not, I don't miss doing that. I'm doing a street piece actually next week, and that tends to be the way I go now. And with street pieces, it's an installation. So literally, we'll roll up in a truck. We'll probably have high-vis vests on, so we look like we're supposed to be there. We'll put the piece out. We'll leave it, take some pictures and go.
Now, is that sanctioned, or you just do that and just make it look like you're supposed to be there?
Yeah, we've got the vests on. Most people won't ask what we're doing there.
No. Act as if.
Yeah, exactly. It's hiding in plain sight.
I like it. I would imagine, that, not to bring up controversy, but one of your favorite subjects is, I feel like that this, if there was not another time for a ridiculous art piece to come, this would clearly be close to it.
It's funny you should say that. I have components around the studio that I purchased yesterday and today for the next piece, which is coming out next week.
I feel the softball coming across the plate here. I feel like it feels like you must be obliged to take a shot at it.
Yeah, this isn't going out for some time, is it?
Probably not for at least for a month.
Okay, that's fine. Let me tell you what it is. It's
amazing. Just sneak peek, everybody.
Yeah, it would have gone out by the time this podcast goes out. But
yeah,
I've just purchased a bathtub, which is going to be filled up with document boxes, which have got a top secret on the end of them, and a toilet sitting next to it, and a crime scene tape around it, and it's going out on Hollywood Boulevard at Trump's Star that's up there on the boulevard.
Ah, brilliant.
Yeah.
And what, you're just going to drop it off in the middle of the night? And
no, we're doing the daytime. Go along there about midday, unload it from the truck, as I say, wearing high-vis vests,
right,
and hard hats like we're supposed to be there, and just
let the pictures come, remind the press that it might be out there, and you're off to the races.
Press release before, saying Hollywood Boulevard,
you know, this date, this time,
1 p.m. or whatever. Yeah.
By the way, that's a really cool idea, because you've inspired me and motivated me, because I'm trying to do some bigger stuff out in the street, and like the idea of just like actually telling people, which I don't know why that was so alien to me.
Just do it.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Some of the things I like to ask artists are two questions of the same coin, which is, what was your, as an artist, what was the biggest mistake you've made? And then the flip side of that, what was the greatest achievement you had as an artist, or the thing that you feel propelled your career the most?
Biggest mistake? Probably becoming an artist and not getting a real job. Way less anxiety if I did that. I don't know, biggest mistake? I'm one of these people that, I don't believe in mistakes. It sounds cliche, but they're all learning experiences.
Yeah, they are.
I don't know, I don't look back on anything. I think a more general mistake that I make and a lot of other artists make is to be passionate about something without really realizing and considering, is this actually going to sell, or am I just doing this because I'm passionate about it? Like a street piece, I can spend hundreds and hundreds of dollars on a street piece and it's not going to sell. Although we've already discussed that it helps raise my profile and bring attention to my work. But I've made pieces of art which have cost me a lot to make and never sold, not street pieces, just because I thought there was a good message in there. I don't think you can be over too analytical about that kind of thing. You've got to get it out of your system. You've got to make it. I'm also thinking about, as a news photographer, I covered stories which were important to me, and I paid thousands of dollars to fly overseas with writers and now the story, and then they're not sold, but they're important issues to me. Sex trafficking of young girls in Eastern Europe, I spent weeks investigating that, and I think it probably cost me about $4,000 or $5,000 to do the story with flyers and hotels and that kind of thing. I think we sold the story for $2,000 to a magazine. I suppose they're the biggest mistakes, but I wouldn't change them, if that makes sense.
Of course.
Get it out of your system. That's it. So the other part of the question, what is the thing that propelled me?
Yeah, like what was the best thing you ever did? Like the best thing as an artist that you're, whether to be most proud of or accelerated your career as such?
I think as an artist, possibly getting help, hiring help in the studio. Because as I said earlier, it frees you up to do the creative stuff. It also means that you've got this responsibility to somebody else as well. You can't just go in your studio and put your feet on your bench and smoke weed or whatever. But that, I cannot say how much hiring help compounds your benefits. Firstly, they're doing a lot of the work for you. The more functional work, the logistical work, the manufacturing, which frees you up. But also, they're coming up with ideas or commenting on your ideas as well, which is equally beneficial as well. So I suppose that's probably the one thing that I'd say to artists, if you can get help, do. And if you've got a profile and you're doing cool stuff, I'm not saying exploit people, but there's probably people out there that would be happy to work with you for the experience for a period of time from what they gain from it.
Yeah, for sure. That's the beauty of the intern. Do you classify yourself as a successful artist? Or a better question is, how would you categorize success as an artist?
When I sell a piece, a canvas, or a print, or a t-shirt, I'm successful. All the other time, I don't consider it successful.
Okay.
I'm not joking there, because as anybody in any field who's self-employed, to get to that point where you have a good revenue stream, sufficient savings, money behind you to be able to just float along is great, but I don't know many artists that can do that. My work often reaches a worldwide audience and pieces sell for thousands of dollars, but I've still got months where I can't make enough money and I'm drawing out of a line of credit and we're watching spending and so on. What is success? Everybody has a different judge. To judge success. So I'm not sure what it is. Creatively, I'm probably successful because I'm making stuff which engage with people. Business-wise, no, I'm broke.
It's never good enough.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think what people don't realize is how many, for every one piece you sell, there's 10 pieces you made that got you to that piece or that don't sell or that didn't do whatever. Some people, I'm always curious. Some people are strictly money-driven. Some people are notoriety-driven. Some people do it, the success comes from the creation, the things that they're creating themselves. Yours are just really compelling to me just because there's so much interesting social commentary and messaging behind it that is, it touches so many more. It really, like, it gets you, right? Like, like they're zingers, right? Like, they definitely give emotion.
Yeah, to me, don't get me wrong, I love the people with enough income to buy expensive pieces. Please keep buying them. But for me, somebody who may not have any money, who may be, in fact, even living on the streets, and I've had homeless guys contact me saying they really connected with the piece, or those students who say, because of your work, I'm now going to start studying art, or I've created this because of the way in which you connected with me. And it's those kind of messages which come through often on email or social media, which really I find, I would say, that is the best measure of success, something that actually means something to you as a person. Fuck, if it's selling a piece for $100,000, if that means a lot to you, great. If it's somebody coming up to you and saying, thank you, you've helped ease the pain from this, or help me realize I'm not invisible, if that means success for you, then great.
Now, just because I know a lot of artists watch this thing, what are, for like artists coming up and cutting their teeth and making it. What are some, I mean, I've given a bunch of tips already, whether you realize it or not, but what are some tips or tricks or things that you would pass along to the next generation that's making art?
I would say experiment, that's the first thing. But second, experiment with your own concepts, your own ideas, but also get feedback. I have some people that come to me and say, hey, Plastic Jesus, hey, Nick, I love what you're doing. Do you think a gallery would sell this? And I look at what they're doing and I try and work out, well, what is the purpose of your art? Is it technically amazing? Is it sending a message? Does it connect with people on a deeper level? What are you trying to do with it? The fact that you put some paint on a canvas, anybody can do that, but what is the purpose behind what you're doing? And will people connect with that purpose? That's the most important thing. I'm not saying it has to have a political or cultural message. It can just be a thing of beauty. Your pieces are amazing, the way in which the flow of the balls that you use and the finish on them, they look incredible.
Thank you.
And is there a deep cultural, political meaning there?
Nope.
That doesn't have to be. They sell on the basis of what they are and how they present themselves. So firstly, get feedback on what you do. That's the main thing. Also, a lot of people, artists, want to get into a gallery, and don't ever go to a gallery and say, hey, I painted this, will you sell it for me? Or will you sell my work in your gallery? You need to go to the gallery and offer them something. So you need to show that, firstly, you're building your own audience. So it might not, if you're selling art, you can go to a gallery and say, hey, I started out a year ago. My pieces were priced at $200. I've sold 10 of them. I'm now charging $300-$400. I've got a following of 5,000-10,000 people on social media. I'd potential in what I'm doing here. So don't just go and see what they can do for you.
You provide value.
Show them that your business model, that your art is growing and being accepted and has potential.
Yeah, and by the way, you never know when it's going to happen. A year ago this time, it's taken me 15 years to become an overnight success. I had 12,000 followers on social media. I did okay sales, whatever it was. A year later, I'll break 200,000 followers this week. When it happens, if you get it right, it can literally happen overnight, especially now because the algos are all so strong. But yeah, I'm with you 100% out there, 100%. Provide value to somebody else. Show them that give more than you take.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's a good way to put it.
So we are coming towards the end of our interview. We've been doing this for about an hour. Are there any projects, obviously your next Trump one, are there any gallery shows or projects or things you have coming up that we should know about?
I don't have any gallery shows or projects. I've got the street one coming out, which will what we're looking at now, which will be late June. So
after perfect. This will launch shortly thereafter. I will piggyback onto that for sure.
Yeah, but I'm also working on a new concept for some new pieces, which aren't particularly controversial, but just over my shoulder here, you can see this pouring paint can. I love this idea. Sorry, this one's incredible.
I love that type of work.
This and the guitar, which I showed you earlier, this idea that a solid object can transition into a fluid. So I'm working on that idea, making some large pieces, hopefully, which will be for outdoor spaces. I can't say too much at the moment, but the idea is it's going to look like an object that's melted into a puddle with an amazing finish on it.
So like your guitar?
Yeah, exactly. And the series is going to be called Transitioning States. And a transition can be from a solid to a liquid. It can be a transition from a concept to a project or to a product. So the whole idea, and a transition can be from one mindset to the other. So that's what I want to encompass in the whole of that project.
I like it. I look forward to it. And I love things that are large scale. I don't know what it is about large scale artworks that just turn me on.
Yeah, for me, doing street pieces, installations, I love it when people just turn the corner and they might see 12-foot-long lines of cocaine or a gold Oscar statue. And it's just that, what the fuck is this doing on the street kind of thing.
Correct.
And so that is, that's worth a lot, I think, to have that kind of feedback, that response.
Yeah, awesome. I'm finally happy to put a face to the name and to see to understand where Stop Making Stupid People Famous came from. This interview has made me very happy. I've actually learned a bunch, so thank you. And as you said at the beginning, everybody, at Plastic Jesus on Instagram is probably the easiest way to find you.
Yep. Great, thanks. It's been fun.
Fantastic. Thanks so much, Nick.
My pleasure. Speak soon.